If all of this is erroneous speculation, and the charge actually is that Robinson is an anti-Semite, or a Nazi, or a serial liar who refuses to submit to authority, it seems like until we hear that, we're going to have to assume that it's this other thing. Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We are recording this episode on Wednesday, May 21st, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent. Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Matt Kennedy, the marriage looms. How is your family doing?
Good. We just, like, our oldest daughter just graduated from college, and now our oldest son is getting married. And man, there's like 20 billion moving parts that I never knew were moving. Even I've done a lot of marriages. I've married a lot of people in my how many years, but man, the family side of it, it's crazy.
It used to be so simple, right? You just walk 100 cows from one family's corral to the other, and it was over.
Exactly.
Are you doing? Is it like a Victorian period wedding? Are you doing like, you know, are you having like games of skill and chance and like a fair
Highland games?
I wouldn't, but if it has some sort of like Wodehouse themed wedding,
Jane. It is going to be on a Sunday morning.
I was going to ask about this. Yes. So how does it work into the context of a service? Is it just a regular matrimony service?
Yeah, I mean, it's it is basically the regular matrimony service with communion, of course. But it's, you know, it fits really well actually, because the regular Eucharistic service on a Sunday is supposed to be a wedding feast, isn't
right.
it? So it's really nice to have an actual wedding and a feast following.
And I assume you'll just continue to preach the Lectio Continua through book you're doing.
We'll be in Leviticus 20 on Sunday.
and Judas fell headlong and burst open. Dearly beloved. There you go.
No, I'm preaching on John 2 in the wedding feast.
That's a good one. Oh, man. Love it. You guys, we promised the people a Calvin Robinson podcast, so here we go. Full disclosure, we've had Calvin on this show, and photographs exist of all three of us arm in arm with him. So he is a friend, but he's also a bit of a lightning rod, and that lightning has hit the ACNA recently, which is why we're going to talk about him today. So maybe we can go over what happened, though surprisingly, there haven't been many updates or statements that I've seen in the last week. What happened does to the reputations of the ACNA and the individual parties involved, and what larger implications it might have for the province. What do we want to do first? Do we want to do a little bit of timeline? Do we want to sort of share overall reactions? How do you want to start?
I think if you could write, if you did the timeline, we could set everything else in context that way.
Okay. So it's a little bit truncated, as people have acknowledged. He's only been in full-time ministry for less than 5 years. He was part of the Church of England until 2022, when he tried to become ordained there and was refused because of his political and theological views. So he became ordained a deacon in the Free Church of England in 2022, then became ordained a priest in 2023, November 4th, 2023, in the Nordic Catholic Church, which considers itself a part of what's called the Old Catholic Communion. Then, famously, January 19th, 2024, he was a speaker at the Mere Anglicanism Conference in South Carolina, at which he gave an address that was poorly received by some, and he was disinvited from participating in a panel the next day of the conference. He was one of the main speakers and then all of a sudden vanished from the rota. Then in early 2025, he is licensed by the Anglican Catholic Church, moves to America, and begins serving as rector or vicar or pastor of St. Paul's Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. January 25th, 2025, he gives a speech at the Pro-Life Summit in Washington, D.C., at which, at the very end of what was apparently a wonderful speech, emulated Elon Musk's quote-unquote potential Nazi salute, my heart to yours. I think that we can put to rest the idea that it was in any way an actual Nazi salute, but it did cause the uproar that he must have assumed it would cause. He has since apologized for that act, I believe. So his license was revoked 4 days later by the Anglican Catholic Church. There's been some discussion about how much, if at all, he was warned about that kind of behavior. The ACC claims that it warned him multiple times. He claims that they didn't. But his license to serve in that church was revoked on January 30th, 2025. Then on May 5th, 2025, just a few weeks ago, he received a temporary license from the REC, the Reformed Episcopal Church, and Bishop Ray Sutton, which is, as we've discussed, a jurisdiction within ACNA. May 12th, a week later, Archbishop Steve Wood of the ACNA writes a letter to the House of Bishops, which becomes public, questioning Calvin Robinson's ability to properly represent the ACNA or even his ability to properly image Christ in general. And then on May 14th, 2025, the license that had been temporarily offered from the REC was revoked. There's some discussion I've seen on Twitter. A canon lawyer suggested that the REC canons actually made that kind of like one-off, not part of the REC licensing impossible, that Robinson would have either needed to join the REC officially or not at all. We haven't really heard exactly why the license was revoked, other than Archbishop Sutton's comments to Robinson, which were, of course, made public like everything has been, that it was in consultation with other bishops that this decision was made. So that's where we are now. I believe I saw on Twitter recently that Calvin does plan to continue pastoring his church, so probably has some oversight from somewhere, but I don't believe that where that oversight is has been made public.
And yeah, it's yeah. What a story. Yeah, like you said, I consider Calvin a friend, and I largely am on his side on a number of, you know, social issues, and notwithstanding his comments on Calvinism and
right
and the Reformation. Right. We largely stand, shoulder to shoulder against the progressive attacks on the church and attempts to subvert it. Which, you know, that's where I think that the most heat comes. And when I'm thinking about this, you guys remember our podcast started when and because of the outspokenness of people on the left in the ACNA, people who would get on social media and say all kinds of very, very, I would say, offensive things.
And didn't we start? I think we actually started when that Anglican Compass open letter that everyone was signing back in 2018 or something, wasn't it? Or 2019?
It was before that. That's 2018. We started in 2020, like 6 weeks before George Floyd.
Well, but we were starting to talk about that because we had a couple of iterations that didn't work. You know, it's like that we were putting together different type ideas of podcasts. At any rate, you're exactly right. But like, I mean, that's.
And we should add, just to be clear, that some of these people who were saying these things have now departed the ACNA for apostate churches like the Episcopal Church.
Right, right. But some of them remain still. And nary a word has come from the Archiepiscopal office or even other Episcopal offices. So then the sudden decision, it seemed like a whiplash kind of thing. One minute Robinson is licensed by the REC. Then you get the Archbishop stepping in with this letter that not only says, hey, he's not a good representative of the ACNA, which if it stopped there, I could understand. Cause you could say, all right, well, he's kind of basically Roman Catholic, except for disagreeing with the Pope. We might then say, yeah, theologically, that he may not be a good representative of the ACNA, but he went on to I would say, denigrate his character, Calvin Robinson's character, in a way that I believe was unfair. That he's unchristlike, doesn't have a pastoral bone in his body. He didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing, but not a pastoral man.
Well, he's not. I'm reading it right here. He doesn't have the ability to model the Christ-like virtues of peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, and love. And so,
how
therefore,
do you know that?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some. I think George and Kevin, I can quote them. George yeah. thinks someone else wrote it, and then Archbishop signed it with some of the language, you know, about
pen.
Reverend Robinson and stuff. That's right, the auto pen. But it, yeah, I mean, I don't. I think that's for me. That's the point. I mean, obviously, we've said before, Calvin's a friend. We were just recently spoke at a conference together. You know, we stay in touch, actually, and it's the personal denigration, which is really, I think. Has colored this in a negative way, because, you know, all of those factual things, like you said, are true, Matt. I mean, we could start grilling clergy about their understanding and adherence to 39 articles. You know, we can start, asking about their Eucharistic theology. We can start, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of things we could start drilling down on and probably find a lot pretty wider than we might even want, dispersion of beliefs and practices. But then to bring it to a level of, well, actually, it's because there's, you know, not any sort of Christian fruit, essentially, in the life of this minister. And I know in conversations with him, that's been the sticking point all along, is that, you know, say what you will about what he says, you know, factually, disagree with him about the origins of critical theory, if you will, or the implications thereof, or all the things, that's fine. But to actually take it to a personal level that you're, you know, either duplicitous, you know, a liar, you're deceitful, all these things which have been implied, if not explicitly said, in all of these controversies, has really been an unfortunate aspect of this whole saga. Because, I mean, I think, say what you will about, again, like what you may disagree with them about, but that's taking someone's character in public like this, seems not only unnecessary, I'm trying to be as sensitive to the language as I can here without, you know, we're men under authority and things, but I do think that there was an overstepping of the personal nature of this critique in Calvin at this place that I hope, you know, could be revisited, you know, not unlike the bishop. Remember the bishop who implied that he had been, you know, that equated him to the demonically possessed, the outburst that, remember that, he walked that back. And so I don't know if that's necessarily what has to happen here, but I think that the way it stands, there's some rightly aggrieved party in Calvin that I think is unnecessary and unfortunate.
Perhaps you guys can fill in the blanks, because unless I'm missing something, other than the alleged pro-Nazi salute and the willingness to speak in ways that are potentially less culturally acceptable, although not profane and not profane, I don't know what Calvin has done that is morally unacceptable.
I was going to say what he's done to cause the backlash, but morally unacceptable. Nothing. I mean, nothing that I know of, and nothing that I think anyone.
There was an attempt to, and I haven't followed these links, but to loop him into, or roll him into that sort of the discourse about anti-Semitism, you know, with, like, I think that Candace Owens got involved in, and sort of the, you know, and saying, I don't know a lot about it, mm-hmm. but I know that was along in the list of things, because at one point he was tweeting something about not wanting to say Judeo-Christian values, you know, and things like
That's
this.
Right.
And I think, you know, I don't want to defend, I don't know enough about what that argument is really about, but I do know that, you know, you can, there's some corners of the internet that are, you know, that are more nefarious than others. And that, you know, you're sort of, that could be seen as a dangerous place to occupy, you know? So again, I don't know, but then again, at the same time, the implication is that somehow he's actually anti-Semitic or a Nazi. I think it's a joke. I mean,
And I guess there's one other thing, is that the ACC claims to have warned him on several occasions about this sort of spotlight and trolling behavior. And he claims that they never did that. So if he is indeed a serial liar in that sense and unwilling to submit to authority, that is something that you could say would disqualify him from leadership in the church, if it's true.
Yeah, and that's the big if. For this kind of public opprobrium to be lodged at him by people in authority, I think there needs to be just cut and dried evidence,
or
some kind of disciplinary process would have had to have taken place, and then a letter like that could have been issued at the end of that disciplinary process, based on the evidence that had been provided. But that's not what happened. And so, you know, I agree with you on the anti-Semitism stuff. I don't think he's anti-Semitic at all. He has expressed views against the state of Israel, which I disagree with. I think he's absolutely wrong when it comes to Gaza and Israel. I'm very much pro state of Israel. But what happens when you do? What I've seen this on X. When you do post something critical of Israel and supportive of a Palestinian state, you attract Nazis. People who are Nazis come on and say, yes, we hate the Jews. And so you don't maybe mean to be associated with those people, but those people associate themselves with you. And then if you have detractors, they're going to pick up on that.
Well, yeah. And he's got like half a million Twitter followers too. So, I mean, you know, it's not like, I mean, every one of them is some sort of paragon of virtue.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, but that's what I mean. That's what I was trying to inelegantly articulate is that, you know, that's a dangerous, that particularly on X or in any sort of social media, talking about those issues is a dangerous place to inhabit, because you're, for the very reason you said, Matt, you're gonna, you know, depending on what you want to read and how, you could be colored in all sorts of different ways. And so, you know, and one could argue perhaps there's been some lack of wisdom in some of those tweets and some of those discussions, you know, the ways that, and there is, but there is a, he is a provocateur, and there is a method to his sort of communication that he's been displaying since the Oxford, you know, since the Oxford Union debate, you know, and the GB News and all the things. And so, yeah, but I think back to the broader picture, you know, I think that to your initial point, Matt, that it did seem that of course this would be the type of person, if there was going to be an action from the ACNA leadership to sort of tamp down on something, it would come with someone who holds Calvin's particular set of convictions publicly, as opposed to the more sort of left-leaning progressive wings of the church. Because as we've pointed out over time, you know, there have been bishops that have platformed, you know, openly heretical authors and speakers. You know, there are canon theologians who hold we'd say like representative Anglican convictions on things. And then
who have called the ACNA systemically racist in so many words.
That's right. And so, and we have, you know, and they're all out there, and, you know, we try to be polite in our objection to some of this, but, you know, that's, we don't have as much power as the press secretary, the archbishop, you know, to levy these verdicts. So, you know, I think that's where, again, like with mere Anglicanism, I think that the reaction highlighted the issue as opposed to actually minimizing it. You know, I think that it made it more of a pronounced deal than it otherwise would have been if just some, you know, 50 person parish in Grand Rapids, Michigan happened to have Archbishop Sutton taking direct pastoral care of a guy who has been pointed out has not had a solid kind of faithful, stable bishop oversight since his ordination, you know. And so the question that I would have had, and I think y'all may have mentioned it too, Matt, on you and Anne, is that I would love to see what Calvin, the ministry that he could actually exercise, public and at his parish, with a godly, faithful, caring bishop, you know, who was not afraid to come in and say, son, you should have restate that or keep going here, or have you thought about that? I mean, this is what a bishop can be very helpful for you. You know, someone actually cares about you and actually wants to see you thrive and succeed, particularly when have such a place of prominence and have, and is sort of have a worldwide global witness on most of the right positions on these places where the culture is attacking the church most directly. And so, you know, I'm hoping somehow that this will resolve itself. I know that there's going to have to be some movement, but it would be a shame to alienate him, I think, from the ACNA, or at least from me personally, and from people of common cause. And I'm hoping that there will be a some resolution. I don't know what that would look like. I may have some thoughts. No one's asked me, but I do think that there's an opportunity here for some reconciliation, and I'm hoping that this won't be the last word.
Certainly some would say that the other side of the coin of him needing stable Episcopal oversight is him needing to stay in the same place for more than 5 minutes to develop that kind of relationship with a bishop.
Well, yeah, I do think maybe this, okay, so I also have been called out for my speech, right? The way
saying strong things online. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes I've been called out rightly. I mean, sometimes people have been correct and correcting me, and it's been good. You know, it's been good to have other voices, you know, kind of sometimes coming in saying, "Hey, Matt, maybe you shouldn't have said that. Maybe you should tone down." I guess what remains to be seen to me, and I say this as a friend of Calvin, is if there were a bishop who was on his side and who Calvin knew to love him, who said to him, "Hey, maybe you shouldn't have said that," or "Hey, maybe you should tone that down a bit," would he obey? And I think that's the open question out there, I think, for Calvin to have, and I think he needs to answer it. I think he needs to be able to, I do think he needs to have that willingness to be truly obedient to a bishop. If that were to happen, I think a lot of this goes away. I do see that he repent. I looked for it today. I couldn't find where he repented of his faux Nazi salute. I couldn't find that, but I've heard on good authority that he has repented. I don't know if that was at the behest of a bishop. If so, then maybe this has happened already, or if that was just because he recognized that he'd done something wrong. I don't know what the impetus for that was, but moving, even though we've been saying how a lot of these moves from bishop to bishop have not been his fault necessarily, it does create the impression that he's unwilling to submit himself to authority.
It's interesting for me to even think about this process, because attitudinally, it seems like Calvin Robinson and I are at the extreme ends of a spectrum where I am perfectly happy, probably not only just happy, but prefer that nobody knows who I am, what my name is, my address, what I look like. I'm perfectly happy to be in my little church Sunday by Sunday for the rest of my life and like never appear on X, period. Whereas I think that we can acknowledge a valuable ministry beyond a parish, though. Certainly the great reformers were parish preachers and had worldwide influence. They wrote books, they wrote tracts. The dialogue that we have on X now is just that in the modern day. So I'm not saying that the way I naturally operate is superior. It's just totally different to think about what it would look like to, at the same time, exhibit a quiet ministry in a parish, what Eugene Peterson, I think it was, called a long faithfulness in the same direction. I think that's his quote. And at the same time, be able to use the gifts with which the Lord has clearly gifted him in a way to build up the church in a much broader way. I'd love to see if that could happen.
Yeah, no, I think I would too. Just speaking personally, the thing that's always driven me in social media realms is my love.
Want to hear this?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a very Christian answer. It's my love for my parish. I know that before things come into my parish, they're out there, and I want to know what they are, and I want to know how, I want to have arguments against them. I want to be able to reason with people in my church about what's happening outside my church, because those things always seep in. So I was important during sexuality the debates to know what the arguments were on the other side that required interaction outside my parish. And sure enough, you know, when we left for the first 7 years of my ministry, that was the conversation I was having, not just with people online on the websites in various places, but also in my parish. So I learned then, and I think it's a valuable lesson, that you've got to, these outside things come in.
Yeah, and they don't stay outside.
You've got to be, they don't stay outside. So, and I think we saw the same dynamic with the submersive church, or whatever it was, emergent church.
Submersive church.
The Captain Nemo church.
and then the wokeness, all that stuff is same dynamic. I mean, I think the church is always lagging behind. So the conversations that you might have in your parish right now might be geared toward what was happening in the outside world in 2020, but but you need to know what's happening and how to face those arguments. So that's been my impetus. I don't know if that's Calvin Robinson's emphasis, but he does seem, I mean, to my outside view, the things that he says and the way that he behaves toward the parish where he's actually been assigned at this point or been hired seem like the sort of things you'd want to hear from a pastor. He wants to give them communion. He wants to preach to them. He wants to care for them. He's looking for their, I think what's driving him to look for Episcopal oversight is not, I have to be a priest, but his need to, his people have to be cared for and they want him to be there with them. So he's trying to find a way to be their pastor. If that sort of concern is driving his online presence, then the extremes, like the Nazi salute kind of stuff, faux Nazi salute stuff, can be softened over time. Those can be seasoned over time. He's still, I know we got people pushing back at us when we said that he was a young man, he's in his 40s, but he, regardless of chronological age, he's a young priest, right? He's only been a priest for 5 years. And so that's still very, very early on in a person's ministry. And you learn a lot and you learn so much in your first 10 years. And he hasn't gotten to that point yet. I think he's got, and I know I'm just repeating other people now and myself as well, but he's got so much potential for being an excellent parish priest who also has an articulate voice in the world.
Yeah. And you know, in personal interactions with him, I mean, I find him, you know, like you said, he's a friend. I mean, he's, you know, so and the description of him from the press release just doesn't cohere at all with my experience with him. And frankly, I don't know, but I don't see anything that he's said or done that I find even particularly, even to the level of outrageous or even egregious. I mean, you know, I may not, again, agree everything down the line, but in terms of like, you know, I don't know. I mean, 90% of what he says, I agree with. I'm glad he's saying it. I hope he says it more. You know, I mean, I don't have any, I don't know if that's getting me in trouble or not, but I've said this to other people and they've disagreed with me, but I will still say it. I still think it has to do with the personal affront that people at Mere Anglicanism took within the ACNA,
oh, absolutely.
You know, right or wrong. And, you know, that he essentially burned all of the bridges there that he could, and there's just no, you know, there's no coming back from that. And so,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. If I were to just make up a scenario in my head that without any evidence, but just what possibly could have happened, I think the similarities between Calvin Robinson being told he cannot participate in the remainder of Mere Anglicanism after his speech, and the alacrity, the speed with which the Archbishop put out this letter, that does suggest there's similar dynamics involved. You know, we know what happened between, or we have a pretty good reason to believe that what happened between his speech and the panel discussion the next day was that there was a lobbying effort on the part of those who were for women's ordination to get him quieted down, canceled out, kicked out of the thing. Now I'm JD. I know you don't know anything about that. I'm not trying to implicate you in any way. These are things that I've heard. So I'm sure you are completely separated from anything having to do with that. I the rumors I've heard have not been from JD Cook, but if that's the case, then I mean, it stands to reason that the same group of people, when they heard that Calvin had been given oversight or licensed by the REC, would have sprung into action to try and do the same thing, get him out. So
because if we can continue to spin this out a little bit more, because the language that we heard around that Mere Anglicanism incident was not, you know, his argument is faulty. It was that he's harming women. That can lead to language like not a good representative of Christ or the ACNA. Rather, because I didn't read the Archbishop's letter as having anything to do with theological problems, even though those definitely do exist, as we've said. It was mostly like he is hurting people and we don't want to be seen as a church that hurts people. And so he can't represent us.
And I think that the unresolved nature of that claim, which we've talked about, back, you know, over a year ago, Mere Anglicanism, that did what he like, was he in fact harming people? Is the argument that he was, you know, that it was unsafe, for there were women clergy in the auditorium who, you know, felt unsafe or had to walk out or whatever, is what he did wrong in that account? You know, you can make all sorts of arguments, which I can listen to, about not speaking on topic, or, you know, being, you know, for all sorts of reasons, you may have not wanted to invite him back. That's fine. I mean, that's, I wasn't in charge of it. That's not my, my decision. But the charge that what he said was in fact harmful, is still floating out there. And it's been made by people. And as long as that's not resolved, well, then you're going to see not just him, but anyone who makes even like a more gentler, even context appropriate argument, similarly, is going to be at least liable for a similar sort of judgment being levied, you know, because at what point can you say, how gently can you say, I genuinely don't believe that the Bible allows for something like a quote unquote woman priest. Like, I don't believe that that is the case. You can say that as gently as you want, but if that in and of itself constitutes something harmful to say, well then, you know, there are a bunch more letters are going to be written, you know, I mean, or at least that's the potential of this type of kind of reaction to a person, because, you know, as much as, I mean, I know we keep saying it, as much as we just could disagree with them about all sorts of things, we have to be able to at least articulate what we believe on some of these things, and for specifically in areas where we may disagree, in order to at least be able to hold these two positions in a way that respects each other without, you know, reverting immediately to you're harming me, or you're sort of, or we're going to revoke your license. So I don't know. It's I mean, that's the subtext of the whole saga, which I think, you know, it's hard not to read into, because if you look, like we said before, at all sorts of other priests and people who are active on the internet, you know, if we want to get this granular with every single thing they say, we could probably find all sorts of people to kick out of the church, you know, to remove licenses from. But that's not happening, except for this guy. And this guy is the one who poked the bear in Charleston in a way that it's still, obviously, it still hurts.
And if we're wrong, if all of this is erroneous speculation, and the charge actually is that Robinson is an anti-Semite or a Nazi or a serial liar who refuses to submit to authority, it seems like until we hear that, we're going to have to assume that it's this other thing.
Yeah.
That's the way the left and the ACNA has operated for the last 5 years or 6 years. It's not just that you might disagree with us on whether or not spiritual friendship is a good or bad thing. It's not just whether you're going to disagree with us about women's ordination. It's, are you a misogynist and a homophobe? That's the nature of the left ideologically anyways. Is there creating a faux morality or a fake morality or a counterfeit morality to glaze on top of their ideology, so that if you disagree with their ideology, you're also a very bad person, you're just evil, because their ideology is inherently good. So when Stanford started, we did countless shows on this, how wokeism or critical theories are just, it's a counterfeit version of Christianity, where you take the language, sometimes the argumentation, and you twist it, creating something new, but then you retain the emphasis on discipline, orthodoxy, and the need to police your borders, and so and guard against false teachers, and so you have that's what the Christian version of wokeism is. It's just a counterfeit of Christianity, where it's been gutted, Marxist categories have been put in, and now we go after the reactionaries and try to destroy them.
Yeah, and I think that it's inherently, because it's not true, these foundational ideologies, and therefore they're unstable, it exposes a brittleness to it, which I think we're observing here. You know, I mean, you'd like to think that a church, a big tent church with broad formularies like we do, could allow for, you know, some odd or some contradictions at points that wouldn't rise to the level of edicts from the archbishop's desk. And yet here we see a situation where instead of absorbing, you know, this guy, now granted, he's got a big voice, but I mean, it's not, you know, for the most part, it's largely Christian, or at least largely in the direction of, I'd like to think most of the ACNA, I'd like to think. But instead of absorbing that, we have this open nerve that when, you know, that is this brittleness that is, you know, provoked by disagreement, to your point, Matt. And that's just a sign of weakness, in my opinion, for the argument itself. You know, and what am I saying? Can you just delete everything
I think,
just said?
No, I think what you're saying is fine, which is just that.
I'm trying to say something. I have stronger feelings about this than I want to be able to communicate, because I'm trying to also be reverent and, you know, deferential and respectful.
This is the kind of thing about which a big tent church like ours should roll its eyes. Like, there goes Calvin Robinson again.
That's kind of what I'm saying.
Rather than flipping out and trying to throw him out of the tent.
That's kind of what I'm saying, and that, you know, we know what he believes. He's very articulate about his positions. If I were his bishop, I would have the most problems with his rejection of the Reformation.
Right. You know,
and that would be my the first place I would begin, and I would want to, you know, educate him, or at least if he were here, we could talk about it and be like, well, if you're going to persist in teaching my people, who are ultimately my responsibility under you, then we're going to have to make alternative arrangements because we're a Protestant church, you know. But that would be a conversation. That's not like a, you know, that's not like I'm not going to jump on Twitter and start saying this heretical Anglo-Catholic is, you know, a detriment to us all or something. And so, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is that I think that, well, particularly for going back to the question of the dual integrities and the presenting blow up that was precipitated by his presentation in Mere Anglicanism, that no argument. The arguments on either side have to be more or less brittle and less reactionary in order for us to have this conversation. It cannot be the case that every single time, even a big platform person dares to articulate the fact that, you know, the majority opinion for Christians down through the history has been that only men should be priests. You have to be able to say that. And if we can't just say that, then there is no dual integrity. There's no way there's no hope for the future of the ACNA going forward. If every time you have this conversation, or every time there's someone that represents this side, they're either labeled, like you said, Matt, a misogynist, or in this case, in part, this is part of the reason, shut down. And it's like, what, you know, because, and that's, again, we could be wrong, like you said, Nick, might be all sorts of other well-documented reasons that just have yet to come to light, in which case, you know, I'll look forward to being proven wrong. But I know it seems like, as far as I can tell, getting the temperature of the reaction across the ACNA for people who largely would agree with Calvin, that this is just a continuation of the attempt to cancel him that has been going on for 18 months since he dared to stand up in Charleston and say that, you know, just as a man can't become a woman can't become a priest, you know. And that's, I mean, that's a bold thing to say. And there's obviously a lot of disagreement there in the ACNA, but he should be allowed to say that.
It's not vulgar. It's not sinful.
And it's not profane. It's not. And so you just, and so again, I mean, I don't know how we're going to go forward, but I think, again, I think that that we should be able to absorb even someone with as big a voice as Calvin into our conversation without resorting to these attempts to just sort of silence them or cut them off.
Yeah, I also think we do have to decide what kind of church we're going to be. I mean, if we're going to be a predominantly left-leaning church, then I guess there is going to have to be some kind of shutting down of voices like Calvin, and we'll have to leave, right? But if we're going to be a church that is traditional, historic, Catholic, Orthodox, biblical, then we're all, you know, we can't be a total. See, this is what Andrew's getting, this point. Like, the ACNA is has been a real free for all, at least for people on the left, and we want to show if the Orthodox side, the biblical side, gained power, we would want to shut that down. So it's no surprise to me they want to shut us down. Of course they do, because when they have power, they're going to want to destroy their enemies. And when we have, if we ever gained authority, we wouldn't want to destroy our enemies. We would definitely want to silence those who are teaching error. So that's where I'm not sure I totally agree with the idea of, hey, let's have a laissez-faire kind of, I'm not sure you were saying this, JD, but I'm not sure we have a laissez-faire kind of church where we tolerate everything people say and just have a good argument. I think the people who are really upset with Calvin don't want a laissez-faire thing at all. They want victory for their side, and they want to shut us up to get it. And they've had fairly decent success at that over the last 6 years. But now there does seem to be a quote unquote vibe shift, and young people are coming into the church now who are far more conservative than ever was expected or imagined. And so, you know, if the Orthodox side does gain ascendancy in the ACNA, I'm not going to be one of those saying, hey, we got to give Scott McKnight room to have J.K. Dume on his podcast.
I wasn't advocating that. I think that we should be able to absorb these statements in the context of a healthy debate, and hopefully one that I think we're actually winning. I mean, I think, you know, we've said this a million times. I mean, I think that you know, the actual scripture, tradition, and reason argument for the kind of traditional arguments around for all these hot button issues, you know, and not just women's ordination, but, you know, you look at the death penalty, you look at, you know, abortion, you look at the thing, you know, things that are, you know, impolite company you're not supposed to discuss in any sort of definitive way. You know, we have some thoughts about it. We have some convictions, and we're going to articulate them. And, you know, for a generation, or at least a certain segment of, you know, what Aaron Wren would call the neutral world, bishops and priests, you know, that's just not winsome. That's not how you evangelize. You know, that's what those right wingers do, but we need to keep politics out of the church. You know, you've heard all these things, and it's just all a way of stepping aside from the cultural opprobrium that comes from actually articulating biblical convictions on culturally unpopular positions, you know? And so, but once you take a couple of blows and you realize that they're not particularly hard to absorb, then you're not as afraid, you know? But until you get the first punch, you know, you live in fear your whole time, your whole life. And so, you know, I think that's what, I agree with you. I think that if we did go, and I think y'all talked about this, through and sort of held up our formularies, you know, if we did begin with things like, you know, we believe in life is from conception to natural death, you know, so this, your support of the NARL or whatever, the National Reproductive Right, or your support even of a down ticket straight Democrat platform, you know, we should talk about that, you know, not because it's political, but because we have these prior theological convictions that happen to work themselves out in various political ways. But, you know, that's the conversation we have to have. And it does touch on, you know, feminism and women in ministry, but that's not the primary issue. You know, we're talking about educating and raising up future husbands and wives. You know, what are the right roles and responsibilities for that? You know, what are you teaching your daughters and sons in your local parish? I mean, if I were a bishop, that's what I would be concerned about if I heard some of the ways that these priests talk. And so, again, I think that the Calvin, you know, has become sort of like but the lightning rod and a barometer, you know, because the way that you respond to him, you know, is sort of a litmus test right now for the ACNA about kind of what, I don't know, for lack of a better word, side, you know, are you sort of a more progressive side of this church and that's the future you want to see? Or is it more of, you know, you see in him, however, ham-fisted at times, someone with common cause who largely is holding the line against common foes. And I think, you know, I don't know what the percentage breakdown would be if we had some sort of way to vote in the ACNA. I'm hopeful that it would be the majority would be sort of more on the traditional, more conservative side. But I don't know. Time will tell. But certainly we're going to do our part to raise up and send out people who at least would however imperfectly, would see in Calvin a friend and a co-belligerent against some of the most pernicious forces of the devil against the church and in the culture that we're facing currently.
Well, that seems like a good word to end on. We are also out of time. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. You can follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thank you to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, and assuming Matt survives wedding weekend, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.